Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspective.
Yes! And Madigan, this was your suggestion this week.
What made
you want to do this?
Yeah. My boyfriend.
Oh, well, okay.
Because my boyfriend's a musician, and he was sending me a bunch of artists that I'd never heard of that are very big, I guess, in the music feminist world. And he was like, you don't know about Margo Price, and you don't know about this person. So he was sending me all these really interesting people. And I found that I'd never really, I don't know a lot about music. I'd never really looked into a lot of these feminist musicians, besides talking about like the Riot Girls and things like that. So I thought it'd be kind of a good way for me, basically, to look further into. I picked someone that I already kind of knew about before, but didn't know enough about. But a good way for me to kind of like learn more about that world of feminism that I didn't really know a whole lot about.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome.
That's why I did it.
I'm interested to see who you have chosen.
Once I say it, you're going to be like, yeah, okay.
Of course. I almost picked Kathleen Hanna. I almost wanted to talk about her because, you know, I brought her up in our second wave feminism or third wave feminism episode. And
she's mentioned briefly in mine.
Again, a wonderful documentary that I brought up in that episode called The Punk Singer, all about Kathleen Hanna. I've seen Kathleen Hanna live. She's amazing. I told you that. Yeah.
I totally forgot. Sorry.
You just gave me the most surprised look.
I just got really excited. I'm sorry.
Right there. I bought that album from the Julie Ruin.
Oh, sick.
A couple of years ago when I went and saw her perform live.
That's awesome.
With the Julie Ruin.
God, we need to get speakers. Max brought over like, I think we counted 150 some records, and that's like a small portion of his records. And we have multiple record players, but no speakers for them.
Yeah, you need speakers.
We're going to go to Goodwill.
You should probably do that.
Yeah, we're working on it, Keegan. We're broke.
But I was going to talk about her. I really think, actually, though, that Kathleen Hanna and the Riot Girls need their own episode.
Agreed.
In general. But actually, who I'm going to talk about today probably could use their own episode as well, but I will try and cram as much in 30 minutes or less. Let's jump in. So I'm going to be talking today about Pussy Riot.
Woo! That was on my list too. I'm glad I didn't do it. Okay.
So, Pussy Riot is a Russian activist punk band / collective. They are not like a traditional band of one group of members. They kind of cycle in and out. They're a very fluid group where membership is open because they are...
They're a collective.
Well, and they're more of a protest movement than they are a band. They do have a band where they release music, and a lot of their protests and demonstrations are done in guerrilla-style concerts, basically.
Do you remember, like, it was probably about, like, 8 years ago or so when everybody was doing that for Halloween?
Well, because about 8 years ago or so is about whenever they were arrested.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of why.
So they were in the news constantly. It became this kind of, like, huge feminist worldwide revolution, the Pussy Riot movement. And you would recognize them as being these women who wore these balaclavas. That's how it's pronounced, right?
I think so.
Yeah, which are those kind of, like, ski masks that you see burglars wearing, but brightly colored ones. And then they would always wear brightly colored little dresses and brightly colored stockings, even in very cold, harsh Russian winter climates.
It's kind of like if Louise Belcher were to have, instead of a bunny hat, a balaclava
over her
head.
Exactly.
That's kind of the whole.
Exactly. Some of their songs include Kill the Sexist, Death to Prison, Freedom to Protest, and Mother of God, Drive Putin Away.
Yes! So, oh my God, I love it.
They cite, you know, again, Bikini Kill and Kathleen Hanna and the Riot Girl movement as being a lot of inspiration for their particular form of protest. And they began their collective or their band in September of 2011 as a protest against Vladimir Putin's announcement that he was going to run again for president in March of 2012. So, as we know, Putin has been president for a very long time.
Yeah.
It is a dictatorship, whether or not, you know, they are willing to admit that that's what that is.
They don't. It's really bizarre with the Russian people that I've known and also with watching interviews of, like, Russian figure skaters, they're often asked about Putin, and it's almost this, like, robotic, like, he's like a grandfather figure. Like, I remember a classmate telling me that in college, and I was just like, ugh.
Well, yeah, because you can't really speak out against Putin, no, or bad things happen to you.
Yeah.
So many people have disappeared from that country. And, yeah, so while they'll continue to say that he is a president, he has been the president for a very long time, and they knew that once he was reelected, in quotes, elected again, in March of 2012, that he was going to be president for the next however many years, the next foreseeable future.
Do they have terms like we do, where it's like every 4 years they reelect?
I'm not sure. I think they're supposed to. But I think that...
Because he's gone more than 8 years.
Well, yes, but I don't think... You know, even in this country, you could just keep running for a long time until we limited it to 2 terms. So that you could only be president for a max of 8 years.
Yet.
I don't think so.
Got it.
I'm probably going to get this wrong. I don't understand Russian history.
Yeah.
So...
It just kind of seems like who would go against him, who would speak out against him, because, like, bad things would happen to you.
Well,
so
that's exactly right. He holds most of the world's wealth.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they say that Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world, but actually, a lot of people think that Vladimir Putin is actually the richest person in the world. He just puts his wealth in people around him. Like, he lets people hold on to his wealth for him. And so... You don't really want to go against somebody who is this rich and this powerful, because if you were to be an opponent to Putin, you would just
disappear.
So he's basically able to hold on to power for as long as he wants.
Jesus Christ.
So people were so upset about this, not just the members of Pussy Riot, but, you know, average Russian citizens, that they called this period of time the Russian winter whenever he was about to be reelected again.
So Game of Thrones.
Yes. Well, it's very cold there.
Winter is coming.
Winter. It's a permanent winter in Russia right now with Putin being in charge. So they had an interview with Vice before a couple of members of Pussy Riot were arrested. And Vice asked them, so what inspired you guys to start Pussy Riot? And one member said, Pussy Riot came to action around the end of September 2011, right after Putin announced that he was planning to return as president and brutally rule Russia for at least 12 more years. Another member said, right, and at that point, we realized that this country needs a militant punk feminist street band that will rip through Moscow's streets and squares, mobilize public energy against the evil crooks of the Putinist junta, and enrich the Russian cultural and political opposition with themes that are important to us. Gender and LGBT rights, problems of masculine conformity, absence of a daring political message on the musical and art scenes, and the domination of males in all public discourse.
Yeah, they really do have high censorship when it comes to, like, the arts and things like that, like what can be said, what can be shown, and also a high censorship about gender identity,
right?
LGBTQ community, things
and
like that.
And we'll get into this, like, as we talk about them as a group and the things that happened in the you know, couple
of
years.
Stepping on your toes.
No, that's
there.
Okay. The couple of years after they kind of, like, developed. But something that is important to keep in mind is that while Westerners in particular were horrified at this, and Western feminists really clung on to Pussy Riot, and a lot of them went as them for Halloween or got tattoos or changed their profile pictures or whatever, is that it's the understanding of feminism in Russia is just so completely different than our understanding.
It's
of
dangerous.
It's very dangerous, and also they're just coming from a place of oppression in a way that I think a lot of Western women haven't experienced in the same way in our own lifetimes. And again, like, there are also themes of, like, freedom of speech that are so deeply ingrained in us as Americans and other Western countries.
That it's bizarre to hear it.
Yeah, that just don't exist there.
Yeah.
Like, they just don't exist there. It's just not something that they're familiar with at all.
Yeah.
So Vice said, why Pussy Riot? And a member said, a female sex organ, which is supposed to be receiving and shapeless, suddenly starts a radical rebellion against the cultural order, which tries to constantly define it and show its appropriate place. Sexists have certain ideas about how a woman should behave, and Putin, by the way, also has a couple thoughts on how Russians should live. Fighting against all that, that's Pussy Riot. And they chose two English words, right? Like, yeah. Pussy Riot, they chose English words. They chose to display them on all their banners in English. And these aren't words that translate easily in the Russian language at all. And so there was actually someone during this Vice interview, because, you know, he interviewed a good number of them, and there was another woman who was like, you shouldn't have told him, like, what Pussy Riot means, because when they're asked on the street by, when they're walking down the street with their banners that say Pussy Riot in English, and, like, guards will stop them or police will stop them and ask them, like, what their banner says, they never tell them what it actually
say?
Says.
They just don't say anything?
They just don't tell them the truth about what it says or what it means. They just don't tell them. So, it's not just, the collective isn't just the band itself. So there's the band itself, and then there's about, like, 15 other members who shoot their videos and edit their videos and get them put up. Yeah. Because they do not take money for any of their performances. A lot of these videos can be found on YouTube, including the one that got them arrested. Yeah. A lot of these performances can be found on YouTube, but they are anti-capitalists, so they don't accept money. They, you know, rush in, kind of like flash mob in, perform, film it, and then get out, typically.
Right.
So, the group was organized in part due to anger over what members saw as government policies that discriminated against women, citing legislation that placed restrictions on legal abortions. According to Tolokonikova, who is one of, like, the big figureheads of Pussy Riot, she's one of the women who was arrested and has kind of become, like, the de facto face of Pussy Riot. Pussy Riot was part of a global anti-capitalist movement which consists of anarchists, Trotskyists, feminists, and autonomists. Pussy Riot saw themselves as feminist artists who were influenced by the Riot Girl movement and musical groups such as Bikini Kill, Oil Cockney Rejects, and writers, activists, and artists. The media tended to overlook the meaning behind Pussy Riot's feminism, the cultural context of which is vastly different from that of Western feminism.
Yeah. It seems very different because of the fact that what you said is that Western feminism, we have a different set of, I guess, rules, laws in America.
And expectations,
where it's a little bit different. Like, you and I having this podcast isn't seen as being a threat or dangerous here because there's freedom of speech to protect us.
Right.
Where for them, they're on a different realm of feminism because they don't have those things to protect them.
Yeah, I mean, and you're also talking about a culture that came out of very oppressive communism, Soviet communism.
Yeah.
So that's where we get all this, like, big brother kind of mentality, where having this kind of free thought was seen as revolutionary and threatening.
Yeah, and being free thinking in that country for a very long time, and I would assume still today, is a dangerous thing because of the propaganda that they're trying to uphold.
Right. So she said that Pussy Riot strove to make it clear that feminism in Russia was still an issue and that post-feminism had not been achieved. The Russian cultural context had to be acknowledged and its feminist notions had to be seen differently than those of Western feminism because in places such as the United States, feminism evolved to general women's issues, whereas in Russia, that was not the case. In Russia, feminism was seen as something that could, quote, could destroy Russia. And that was said by Kirill, I don't know if I'm saying that right, and he was the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. So you have the head of the Russian Orthodox Church saying that feminism could destroy Russia. Like, that's how they see it, as that kind of massive threat. So where they stand on LGBT issues. Pussy Riot members were outspoken in their support of LGBT rights, and in a 2012 interview, they confirmed that the group included at least one member of a sexual minority. This is also something to keep in mind. Homosexuality is illegal in Russia. So that's also why they're being very vague about someone in our group is a sexual minority without kind of going into details about that.
I know someone who's still in the States from Russia because she is, like, here on asylum, basically, for being gay.
There were several members of Pussy Riot who attended a banned 2011 gay pride rally in Moscow, and they were briefly detained after the rally was broken up by police. In a 2018 interview, Tolokonikova spoke about the importance of transgender rights to the band, explaining that she rejected gender essentialism and stated that we believe you don't actually have to have a vagina or clitoris to be a woman, and having a clitoris doesn't necessarily make you a woman. We are always saying that anybody can be in Pussy Riot, and we really mean it. So,
very intersectional.
Yes, and that's kind of the setup to get us to what made Pussy Riot internationally famous.
Yes.
Which I think is kind of interesting, because before, yes, a lot of people in Russia knew who Pussy Riot was, and they actually weren't very well liked in Russia
for obvious
reasons. But before this, they weren't highly known in other parts of the world.
Right.
And so by doing what they did, they actually catapulted and put a national spotlight, an international spotlight, on not only Pussy Riot, but also the conditions that people are living in Russia.
Yeah.
So it backfired on them.
Oh, yeah.
On February 21st, 2012, Pussy Riot staged a performance of their song Punk Prayer inside Moscow's Cathedral of Christ the Savior.
Ooh.
Some of the lyrics include, "Virgin Mary, Mother of God, banish Putin. Join our protest, Holy Virgin."
Yes!
The group's actions were condemned as sacrilegious by the Orthodox clergy and eventually stopped by church security officials. The women said their protest was directed at the Orthodox Church leader's support of Putin during his election campaign. On March 3rd, 2012, two of the group's members, Nadia Tolokonikova and... So, I'm going to shorten these because I don't want to butcher these names. So a lot of their names, it was Nadia and Mara were the two that were arrested that day.
Okay.
And they were charged with hooliganism, which, like, is the most punk rock thing ever.
I want to be arrested with hooliganism.
Like, could you have chosen a more punk rock thing to get
it
arrested
with? It rhymes with my name, kind of. Madigan the Hooligan?
Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
They initially denied being part of the group, and they staged a hunger strike while they were in jail. And that was on the 3rd. On the 16th of March, a third member, Yekaterina Samutsevich, was arrested.
Sounds good to me.
Sure. And on June 12th, the indictment was published. They accused, and this is funny. This is super funny to me. They were accused of, quote, blasphemous humiliation of the church. The prosecution called their outfits defiantly bright and accused them of jumping, lifting up legs, imitating dancing, and punching, which contributed to, quote, severe public disorder. Which I think is... it's hilarious.
I'm just picturing the dance moves, too, and it's so, like... they're reaching so far. They're like, what can we bring them down with?
It's hilarious, but it's also, like, kind of terrifying that...
It's so terrifying.
It's so puritanical that you can be like, what? Is this a town in Footloose? Like, you're upset that they're dancing in a church? Oh, my God.
Sorry to be laughing, but sometimes it's the only way that I can, like, deal with something that's so absurd.
And during their indictments and, like, when they were seen in court for, like, pretrial things
or
whatever.
Did they wear their balaclavas?
They didn't. But I guess the way that the courts are set up in Russia, they put them in essentially, like, a little cage thing, like off to the side. They don't sit down at tables in front.
Up and away.
And when they were doing it, you can see pictures of them, and you can kind of see, like, they look like they're kind of smirking, like they're kind of
amused,
defiant.
Yeah.
And they were accused of maintaining a, quote, Western and unfeminine attitude throughout the trial.
How dare they?
They were basically like, fuck you, fuck this.
Yeah.
And instead of being
taking
contrite
it seriously.
Or being, you know, feminine and, like, crying and being sorry.
Or being, oh, I'm so sorry I did this.
And
I'm so sorry.
Essentially, yeah, they wanted them to ask for forgiveness, essentially. And they weren't going to do that. So there was worldwide outcry, but especially in the West. Like, the West saw this and they were like, this is insane. Like, you have these girls in jail, these women in jail for what we would deem to be free speech.
Yeah.
And you can say that this song was blasphemous. It was a little bit.
I mean, think about all the songs that have to do with, like, I've been to plenty of live shows where musicians will mention Trump.
Right. You know? I mean, and I truly feel like it had less to do with the fact that it was blasphemous towards the religion and more to do with the fact that it was bad-mouthing Putin.
Totally.
You know, and they were able to get them on this kind of religious hate crime charge.
Right, they could disguise it as that.
Right, because that is essentially what they got them on, is a hate crime.
They were in a church, so they were like, okay, what can we do here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the three detained members were declared political prisoners by the Union of Solidarity with Political Prisoners. And on March 25th, Amnesty International named them prisoners of conscience due to the severity of the response of the Russian authorities. The trial of the three women started in Moscow on July 30th, 2012. They were charged with premeditated hooliganism performed by an organized group of people motivated by religious hatred and hostility. So it's a religious hate crime, essentially, is what they're being charged with.
Even though the messages that they're sending, like, they mention the Virgin Mary, that they're in a church, I get it, but, like, the messages that they're sending aren't necessarily even anti-religious.
I mean, I think they may have said some things. I think that they were...
They could have, but...
I think that they were saying some... They were kind of, like, playing on old hymns and doing things like that, which
right.
would be considered blasphemous in old-school kind of Christianity circles. It would be, but that's not against... The blasphemy is not against the law.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a hate... Being blasphemous isn't a hate crime.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That's crazy.
Either that or, you know, SNL would have been shut down years ago.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we would all be in trouble if that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so they faced a possible sentence of up to 7 years in prison for this. 7 years in prison. It's insane. The defendants pleaded not guilty, saying that they had not meant their protest to be offensive. Tola Konikova said, "We sang part of the refrain, 'Holy shit! I'm sorry if I offended anyone with this. It is an idiomatic expression related to the previous verse about the fusion of Moscow patriarchy and the government."
I love it. She's like, "Guys, I had to refer back to this verse."
Right. Listen,
it's not a big deal.
Sorry.
Like, it's music theory 101. You refer back to the verse in the refrain. It's fine.
"Holy shit is our evaluation of the situation in the country. This opinion is not blasphemy." Their lawyers stated that the circumstances of the case had revived the Soviet-era tradition of a show trial. On August 15th, 20 protesters wearing balaclavas gathered in support of Pussy Riot at Christ the Savior Cathedral and held up placards reading, "Blessed are the merciful." Cathedral guards quickly moved against the protesters, trying to detain them and taking off their balaclavas. All three were convicted by the judge and sentenced to 2 years in a penal colony on August 17th, 2012.
But there's something so personal about going up to somebody and pulling an item of clothing or
right.
even a hat off of
right.
them that has leaves such a bad taste in my mouth when I think about it in the image of these security guards
it's
coming.
Assault.
It is. And ripping these balaclavas off their heads is such a jarring image in my head.
Right. It's,
you know?
It's assault. Like,
yeah.
you... And, you know, they would probably argue that they felt threatened because these identities were being concealed and, you know, things like that. You're usually not
but
supposed to wear...
Then they can detain them. They can handcuff them,
right.
detain
I mean,
them,
in
pull
general,
them aside, arrest them, whatever.
Even in the United States, when we go to rallies or protests, they tell you that there are certain rules that you do need to abide by. Like, you know, if you have a sign, it can't be... The thing that you're holding it on can't be... thicker than however many inches, because then it could be a weapon.
Yeah.
And one of those things, even here in the United States, is that you can't have your face covered.
I get it, totally. But you can, there's something very, very jarring about that image.
The imagery of actually physically pulling something off
yeah,
of someone's
face. Yeah, and I feel
face.
Like there's other ways to detain them.
Well, of course.
Pull them aside.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a very, just like, visceral
it's aggressive.
Image. You know what I mean? It's very aggressive.
Yeah. The judge stated that they had crudely undermined the social order with their protest, showing a, quote, complete lack of respect for believers. I'm sorry. You're not owed respect.
No.
You're not.
That's like part of religion. It's kind of like having your own beliefs, even though other people may not agree with you. Like, I just remember that being a lot
right.
about, like,
I mean,
my
and they
Catholicism.
Weren't, they weren't being directly hateful to any particular believers, in which
no.
case I would say, like, that's inappropriate and wrong, and you should never... I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that to Christians. I wouldn't do that to Muslims. I wouldn't do
right.
that to Jewish people. But to say that singing a song in a church that you disagree with is being blatantly, like, It's just,
yeah,
that to me, that's ridiculous. Mark Fagan, a lawyer for the trio, stated that they would appeal the verdict, but that, quote, under no circumstances will the girls ask for a pardon from Putin. They will not beg and humiliate themselves before such a bastard. Tola Konnikova stated that, quote, our imprisonment serves as a clear and unambiguous sign that freedom is being taken away from the entire country.
Yeah.
Protests were held around the world after the sentence was announced. Amnesty International declared August 17th Pussy Riot Global Day for activists. Yeah. People gathered in New York City where actress Chloe Sevigny, Karen Finley, and others read statements by the convicted members of the band. In Bulgaria, people put masks similar to those worn by Pussy Riot on a Soviet sculpture, and about 100 people protested outside of the Russian consulate in Toronto.
That's rad.
So the world was in an uproar.
Yeah.
People everywhere were pissed. And this was probably around the time, like what you're saying, when you saw people like going yeah. at Halloween. It was probably around this time.
Yeah.
Because it was everywhere. I remember seeing it all over. It was right whenever I was starting to get into like Jezebel comment sections. And yeah. I was like seeing these articles come up constantly at this time. So many international artists, politicians, and musicians voiced support for the release of Pussy Riot or expressed concern about their fairness, the fairness of the trial, including Madonna. Madonna performed in Moscow around this time, and she interrupted the middle of her own performance in Moscow and, you know, kind of defended Pussy Riot, took off her shirt, and she was, like, in a bra, and on her back she wrote Pussy Riot on it.
Yeah, girl.
And Bjork dedicated her song Declare Independence to their cause and invited them to join her on stage to sing with her. While acknowledging the support, members of Pussy Riot distanced themselves from Western artists and reiterated their position, mm-hmm. Their opposition to the capitalist model of yeah. art as commodity. One of them, identified as Orange, said, we're flattered, of course, that Madonna and Bjork have offered to perform with us, but the only performances we'll participate in are illegal ones.
Yeah.
We refuse to perform as part of the capitalist system at concerts where they sell tickets.
Awesome. Sticking with their guns.
No, their integrity is
amazing.
Insane. Yeah, because at this point, they really could have capitalized on their fame. They had 100%. International fame at this point. And they were like, nope, no
thank you. It's amazing. I love it.
On December 19th, 2013, the State Duma, I don't know what that is, approved a general amnesty for various prisoners. Among those who qualified for amnesty were those in prison for nonviolent offenses and mothers of young children. So two of the women, Nadia and Mara, I think, both had children.
Oh.
Like, Nadia.
Nadia.
Just gonna call her Nadia. So Nadia had a daughter at 18. So
yeah.
Her daughter was, I think, like 2 or 3 whenever okay. she was initially arrested.
Yeah.
And
I mean, that's great that they did that.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Tell me more. We'll
get there.
Okay, great.
It was, so these two were released in December, on December 23rd, 2013. Following their release, Mara went to meet with human rights activists, and she said, we didn't ask for any pardon. I would have sat here until the end of my sentence because I don't need mercy from Putin.
Yeah.
This says Maria, by the way, but I've heard it said Mara. So either way, it's M-A-R-I-A, which is Maria, but I've heard them call her Mara. So
okay.
She told the New York Times that after her release, Nadia said, I think this is an attempt to improve the image of the current government a little before the Sochi Olympics,
yeah.
particularly for Western Europeans. But I don't consider this humane or merciful. This is a lie. Whether one likes it or not, going to the Olympics in Russia is an acceptance of the internal political situation in Russia, an acceptance
yeah.
of the course taken by a person who is interested in the Olympics above all else, Vladimir Putin. So she's calling
Russians,
people fucking out.
Yeah, and the Russians, the Sochi Olympics were when, were Russians as a whole banned from the Olympics, or was it just in figure skating?
Oh, I don't know.
Because the latest Olympics, they couldn't compete under Russia. They were under something else. I can't remember what
well,
it was.
Well, I mean, there's a whole documentary.
The doping.
Yeah, that whole documentary, Icarus, which
yeah.
I have not watched. But
I want to watch it so bad. I still haven't watched it. But it's all, like,
they
the
cheated
doping.
Hard fucking core
yeah,
through that entire thing.
Core. The doping yeah. was insane. So, like, it's just funny how that all, like, coincides, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and the things that they did, I can't believe. The human rights violations that were happening in Russia, This also coincided with them, you know, making homosexuality illegal and all of the things that they were doing in Russia at the time. And we all fucking showed up anyway.
Yeah.
And so I love that she she pointed a finger at them and said, like, this is your kind of like turning the other cheek is accepting this behavior in Russia and basically saying, like, we don't care about the Russian people. And I love that both of them were like, and, you know, she has said since then, Nadia has said since then in a recent interview that I read that she has nightmares of going back to prison. It's not like they were having
a
good time.
Yeah.
They weren't enjoying it. They were in like a big room with 100 other people.
Yeah.
And it was terrible for them. But both of them are like, we would have sat in Russia or in Russia. We would have sat in prison for the rest of our time because we don't want to take these kind of like this faux sympathy from anybody in these handouts that try and make Putin look like he's a decent human being when he's not.
Exactly. I'm seeing that. I know that at least in figure skating, they won the group, the country's title, because now there's like you compete for your country and then you compete individually, and those titles were taken away from them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Good. So the two of them said that they would not be performing in shows, but were starting to organize, we're starting an organization to work for better conditions for prison inmates, and that they still wanted Putin removed from government. Mm-hmm. Both said that Soviet dissident Vladimir Bukovsky is their role model, a man whom Tolokonnikova said is a human rights champion undeterred by fear. In February 2014, a statement was made anonymously on behalf of Pussy Riot members, and they said that Nadia and Mara were no longer members. However, both of them did perform. They both said that they weren't going to perform again, and Pussy Riot was like, they're no longer members. But I think they were so pissed off when they got out about the Sochi Olympics that both of them performed as Pussy Riot during the Winter Olympics in Sochi.
They could be anonymous.
Yeah.
That's the cool thing.
Yeah. And group members were attacked with whips and pepper spray by Cossacks who were employed as security guards for the Olympics. On March 6th, 2014, both Nadia and Mara were assaulted and sprayed with green paint by local youths in Nizhny.
Oh, my gosh.
Nizhny Novgorod. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
It's a difficult language.
It is. It is. I tried to learn Russian once, and I learned very, very little before I was like, okay.
I know some swear words.
Yes.
That's about it. There'd be, like, little, like, 11-year-old skaters falling and swearing in Russian.
Yes, I can say I speak Russian, and I speak English, and I'm American in Russian.
Let's do it.
So... я понимаю че по-английски is I speak English. Я понимаю по-русски is I don't speak Russian. I'm not sure what that is. Я американец means I'm American. Yeah.
Yeah. Lord, Keegan, I've known you for like almost, what, 9 years?
Listen, my mom gave me an option whenever I was like... whenever I was a little girl, my brother and I, she was like, you can get tapes to learn whatever language you want. And I chose Russian. And it was a bad choice, but like...
That's an awesome choice!
Yeah. So I know, like...
is it weird that I'm like a little turned on right
it's
now?
It's kind of a sexy language, actually.
It's kind of aggressive, but I'm kind of into it right
now. Yeah. Nimnoga means a little. I know a little bit.
I'm gonna take that ring off your finger and put my own ring on that finger and you're marrying me now.
I would actually like to take it back up, even though I'll never use it, but it was a fun language to start trying to learn.
Great language for me to learn growing up. I'm kind of jealous right now. That was an amazing little
Pimsleur,
tidbit. I
didn't
Russian. Know about you.
Pimsleur. You can probably download it online now. I used old school tapes.
Yeah, I feel like I should learn Spanish, but
we all should learn Spanish.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Okay, so horrible things are happening to them. They got whipped and pepper sprayed at the Olympics, and then they were also assaulted by young people. This is a constant theme. Like, you can see pictures of them being interviewed.
Yeah.
And there are lots of, like, young people who support Putin who... There was one where they were
because
being interviewed.
Because that's how they're raised.
And there was, like, a young person who supported Putin in the back with a raw chicken. He threw a raw chicken at them, which I'm just like, that... I mean, it's not funny, but it's also kind of like, why chicken?
Why? But, like, why raw meat in general? general. It's just weird. Kind of like, I don't get it.
Speaking as much to Western European and North American audience as to Russian audiences, in 2016, Pussy Riot anticipated a Trump victory and 2 weeks before the vote released a song called Make America Great Again, depicting a dystopian world where a President Trump enforces his values through beatings, shaming, and branding by stormtroopers. In describing the video, Rolling Stone magazine noted that jaunty, carefree music contrasts the brutal events depicted on the screen. This is 2 weeks before the election.
And I gotta say, I love it when that happens in movies and in music, when they're discussing a very serious topic or they're doing something very gruesome and serious, but then there's like a very joyful tune in the background. Like that, I love that. It's my favorite thing.
So Pussy Riot continues to operate, and just last year I started like looking into like what people are doing now. Nadja continues to be a conceptual artist. She travels to the United States. I read an interview with her that came out just a couple of months ago where she was talking about her daughter is now like 6 or 7, and she has like a very open, she has conversations with her daughter about politics. Her daughter knows who Obama is and Trump is and Putin is, and
that's
She has, you know, very open conversations. Yeah. And in September of last year, one of the group's members, I'm going to say this wrong, it's spelled P-Y-O-T-R, but I'm guessing that's Peter in Russian.
Yeah, I would say that's Peter.
Peter Verzilov was hospitalized, and he is Nadja's husband. He was also a member of Pussy Riot.
Right.
He was hospitalized in September of last year, and he was held in the toxicology section of the intensive care unit in Moscow, where it was suspected that he was poisoned. So, that is Pussy Riot.
Oh, dear.
They, you know, their music is very, very similar to Bikini Kill, to that Riot Girl punk kind of.
They're paying homage, but in their own non-Western
way.
Well,
I mean, and it's a great way for people who aren't musicians, who are doing it more of as a political act, to be able to do it, because you only really need to know, like, 3 chords.
Yeah.
It's a lot of, like, scream singing.
Yeah.
But it's for a cause and purpose, and they've done such amazing work. That I was so impressed with them whenever I was doing research on this.
Yeah.
It's rare to find people who believe in something so wholeheartedly and strongly that they can stick to their guns through this kind of treatment.
Yeah.
They were hospitalized several times for hunger strikes while they were in prison. It's just a fascinating...
Their integrity
and
their passion is so inspiring.
Yeah.
So inspiring.
It is.
So, this is a person that I've always known the name, I've always known the band, it's always been a buzz, but I didn't know a lot of the social impact that this person had and was a feminist. And this person is not a woman, this person is a man.
Is it Kurt Cobain?
It's Kurt Cobain.
Of course it is.
So, the reason I really wanted to do Kurt Cobain, there was a lot of women that I wanted to touch on, but there's something, that I have a special place in my heart for men who take such a stand for feminism.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me feel really good. So, I'm going to tell you guys about Kurt Cobain, even though you guys probably know a lot of this already, I'm going to tell you anyways, because I found this so heartwarming and fascinating. I'm not going to go into his whole life story. I'm not going to go heavily into his drug use. I'm not going to go heavily into his relationship with Courtney Love, because that's not the point of this episode. But I will give you some background, and I will give you some of that information, because that's just part of his story. So his name is Kurt Donald Cobain.
Donald,
named after his father.
We're going to have to retire Donald after this.
Sorry, Donald Duck. He was born on February 20th, 1967 in Aberdeen, Washington, to a waitress named Wendy and an automotive mechanic named Donald. He had a very musical family. His uncle's name was Chuck Bredenberg, and he was in a band called the Beachcombers, and his aunt was named Marie Earle, who played guitar for a lot of different bands in the area. Kurt is described as a happy, creative, and sensitive child, which is probably how people would have described me as a child. He showed really early artistic talent in drawing. He would draw, like, very kind of blasphemous cartoons of different people and political figures and musicians and things like that. His aunt said that he started singing at the age of 2 and started playing piano at 4, and he once wrote a song about the local park.
There is a documentary.
Is it the montage of Heck?
Yes.
I was trying to watch it today and I couldn't find it on any platform.
It's on HBO.
We looked.
Oh, it's an HBO documentary. That's what I watched it. That's what I watched it on years ago. Maybe they did take it down. I did watch that, and you can see some of his drawings and stuff in that.
Yeah.
And some of his, like, you know, of course it becomes very, very heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And depressing. But they do show you, like, a lot of his poems and
He was a very, like, intelligent, artistic child, very much so. So when Kurt was 9, his parents divorced, and he took this really, really hard. His father remarried, and he actually really, really liked his stepmom. But his mother began dating a very abusive man. Kurt would witness his mother being beaten, and one incident actually landed her in the hospital. But Wendy refused to press charges against the man and stayed with him. So that was really, really hard on him to be witnessing all of this abuse and not really see his mom doing anything about it.
I know it's very difficult. You know, we did a whole domestic violence episode.
Yes.
I know it's incredibly difficult, and I don't blame women who have difficulty in these situations, in domestic violence situations, but it's always hard for me whenever I'm like, but there's a kid, though.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where I think that the person involved, the mother in this example, would be saying, like, but I can protect my child, and it's hard sometimes when you're in that situation to think about how it may be affecting the child.
You know, you should send your kid to go live with his dad.
Well,
you know,
that's kind of what happens. So
yeah.
This resulted in, well, first of all, before that happened, Kurt began really distrusting adults, and he actually began bullying a kid at school. And this kind of got to a point where his father took him to a therapist who said that he would benefit from a single family home instead of bouncing back and forth between homes. And in 1979, Kurt's mom granted full custody to his dad, Donald. So now
it's the right call.
Now, well, he does kind of go back to his mom. But when he's a child, he goes to live with his father and his new stepmother, who it seems like he actually liked. But eventually, Kurt's teenage rebellion became too much for his father. So he went to live with a born-again Christian family friend named Jesse Reed, and he became a devout Christian for a short period of time. And he would later denounce his faith in Christianity, but he did have a song called Lithium where he talks a little bit about his Christian faith as a child. So in high school, Kurt befriended a gay student at school, and he began being really bullied for it, as was this other gay student. His classmates assumed that he was gay as well. In an interview, Kurt said he liked being associated with a gay identity because he didn't like people, and when they thought he was gay, they left him alone. His mom didn't want him to be around this new friend, Kurt says, because she was a homophobic. He would spray paint trucks with sayings like, God is gay and homosexual sex rules. In his personal journal, he wrote, I am not gay, but I wish I were, just to piss off the homophobes. He also says in an interview, I started being really proud of the fact that I was gay, even though I wasn't. He would later describe himself as being gay in spirit and would probably be bisexual. He would also describe himself as being more of a feminine child. He liked to wear dresses and other articles of clothing that were only accepted for girls. He says at this time as a child, in a community that stresses macho male sexual stories as a highlight of all conversation, I was an underdeveloped, immature little dude that never got laid and was constantly razzed. Oh, poor kid. It bothered me. So I think that's really interesting is like, this would have been like the late 70s, early 80s, things like that, where he's speaking very much like this would be today, speaking about a childhood where he wasn't accepted in the way he liked to play, the way he liked to dress, the way that he was as being, you know, maybe more of a sensitive, quote unquote, feminine spirited child, being a little boy in this macho machismo world that wasn't very accepted.
Right.
And I find it so heartwarming that he befriended this gay student. And even though he was kind of masquerading as this gay person, he grew through that, this understanding and also this sense of freedom in a way that he had a reason to be different.
And for me, it almost comes across as less of masquerading and more of like someone, a child trying to figure out what his identity is.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
He did kind of struggle with that a bit because he had this feminine side and he was friends with a gay student at his school where he was kind of like, am I gay? And kind of had this realization that like he may be bisexual, but he's always kind of been with women
and this is like also kind of what happens when we try and shove children into these boxes.
Yeah.
Like, they don't need to have these kind of identity crises trying to figure out, like, if I'm having these thoughts or feelings or these friends or if I want to wear this, does that mean I'm gay? Like,
yeah.
It doesn't have to mean anything. You know,
just be you like what you like.
You just like what you like. You know?
So he would also be quoted saying, "I definitely feel closer to the feminine side of the human being than I do the male, or the American idea of what a male is supposed to be. Just watch a beer commercial and you'll see what I mean."
Yeah, accurate. I love it.
Very accurate. His experiences with toxic masculinity in his culture was told in the song "Then a Son," which is a story about how it's easier to be born a boy than a girl. It's also exposed a double standard in raising boys and girls, how girls experience victim blaming and slut shaming where men do not experience the same scrutiny. So in that song, it's kind of like, some people say it's about his sister where his father wishes that his sister were born a boy, born a son. But he's kind of talking about how he sees the differences between the ways that he was raised. He acknowledges some of the toxic messages that were being sent his way of how he was supposed to act. But he's also realizing the fact that the girls he's growing up with have it off much worse than he does. And how probably the things he's struggling with are mirrored a lot in the ways of that how girls struggle. But I think that the idea of toxic masculinity definitely wasn't a thing that was talked about growing up.
And it sounds like he kind of stumbled upon that without having the words to say it.
There's a lot of things that he talks about where they're the ideals of today, but he's speaking about them in the 80s and
90s. Even talking about how he doesn't relate to what we equate to be masculine.
Yeah.
And relating that to a beer commercial. Yeah. It's what he's saying is toxic masculinity.
He is. Yeah. 100%. It's very fascinating. So Kurt dropped out of high school 2 weeks before graduation since he didn't have enough credits. He was living with his mom at the time, and she told him that he had to get a job or get out. So he got out. Good old tough love. He was homeless for a time. He would sleep on friends' couches. He would sneak into his mother's basement. And he would say that he often slept under a bridge at Wishkaw River, which inspired the song Something in the Way. He eventually found escape in the Northwest punk scene in Seattle. Kurt befriended and was heavily inspired by the female punk rock scene that was the Riot Girls. He dated Toby Vail for a short time and became friends with Kathleen Hanna. So when he dated Toby Vail, it was like they weren't really dating. Like, I think that they were kind of like together, but Toby Vail saw like the conventional relationship as being very sexist. Mm-hmm. But I think in a way, by that happening, that opened his eyes even more to like what conventional relationships are and like how they could be sexist at the time.
Right.
And I think he learned a lot from these women, and I think they really heavily influenced his music, too.
Well, they did. I mean, if you watch the punk singer, she talks about her relationship with Kurt. They were very close friends, Kathleen Hanna and Kurt Cobain. And she gave him Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Yeah.
Like, that was Kathleen Hanna.
Yeah.
You know, she's got a picture where she graffitied, like, I think it says, "Kurt smells like Teen Spirit," or something like that.
That's cute. I need to see that, and I need to see...
That one's a hard one to find. You have to, you have to buy it on Vudu, or you can rent it on Vudu, or you can buy it on, like, Amazon. But it's not for free anywhere.
Right.
Or it's for free on YouTube, but you have to watch it in, like, really weird... Like, it's like...
Parts?
No, it's like, you know how they do it to, like, avoid copyright, where it's, like, small, like, like, zoomed
it's
in.
It's like a galaxy photo with, like, a tiny, tiny little picture.
Right, yeah.
So, well, again, like you said, they spent a lot of time together talking about political and philosophical issues. So I think it's, like, that was a really eye-opening period of time for him as well.
Because yeah, it sounds like he already had the seeds of feminism, kind of just
like
the way
found
that
his,
he...
like, group a little.
He found his people, and they kind of, you know, we all need that little bit of guidance to give us the words for what we're feeling, and that's what the Riot
Girls
were for him.
They kind of watered that seed a little
It seems like.
Because of his childhood experiences, he focused a lot of his activism toward the gay community. In 1989, during the AIDS crisis, the general consensus was that the only cause of AIDS was homosexual sex. And there were a lot of quotes that I wrote about this, and I think that we'll get into it more during Coming Out Month. The whole idea behind the AIDS crisis being strictly a gay issue and the fear that was ignited.
We could have an entire episode about this crisis and Reagan's...
Let's do it next month,
girl. Let's do it next month.
Doing it.
This crisis and Reagan's response to it, because it will infuriate and sicken you.
And like, that is the point of your angry neighborhood feminist.
Yeah. If you want to be mad and prepare yourself for that episode that we do, go watch How to Survive a Plague.
Yeah.
Because that
I wanted to see that
ruined me. It ruined me.
Yeah. I think I heard the True Crime Obsessed podcast, I think, did an episode on
that. I was crying alone. Like, I was just, like, alone watching it, just sobbing. It's terrible. Anyway, I mean, it's great, but terrible.
So, during this time in 1989, Nirvana began its heavy anti-homophobia rhetoric, and on August 22nd, 1992, so I was a little over a month old, just had to think of it in that
sense. Sure, sure.
They played a benefit concert at Portland Meadows, which opposed Measure 9. So Measure 9 was an initiative to amend the state constitution, which would ban promotion of homosexuality. It would also mandate that schools, quote, shall assist in setting standard for Oregon's youth that recognizes homosexuality, pedophilia, sadism, and masochism as abnormal, wrong, unnatural, and perverse. And the behaviors should be discouraged and avoided. The fact that homosexuality is in the same breath as pedophilia.
Yep.
Just.
Yeah.
Doesn't sit well with me.
Shouldn't.
No, it really doesn't. So before the show, the group said, Measure 9 goes against American traditions of mutual respect and freedom, and Nirvana wants to do their part to end bigotry and narrow-mindedness everywhere. At the time, they were kind of like at a war of words with Guns N' Roses, particularly Axl Rose, who Kurt thought wrote like very homophobic and racist lyrics. I've read some of them.
He did. Yeah, I mean, Axl Rose is a trash person.
He's a jerk. So in response, Nirvana refused to tour with Guns N' Roses. It sounds like they had a tour like planned, and Kurt was like, nah, we're not doing this. They were then saying no to millions of potential dollars going on tour. Like, that tour was so successful, and they were like, we will not be a part of this. And that made Axl Rose call Kurt a pussy, which is like, ooh.
Also, you way hurt to me. Prove my fucking point.
Exactly.
Like, you proved my point.
Oh, that hurts my feelings. Whatever. Kurt would also reject the bands Aerosmith and Led Zeppelin, saying that he liked the melodies, but it took him a long time to realize how sexist their music was. He said they just wrote about their dicks and having sex.
That's right.
Yeah, so he just had a real, you know, and most, like, love songs are really toxic in a way, and we kind of move past it. I do this thing sometimes where if I'm singing a song that a man is singing, I'll, like, flip the pronouns sometimes and hear what it would sound like from a female's perspective, and it sounds very bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually pretty incredible. I mean, and I think it's part of why the grunge scene and the punk scene came up, or the Riot Girl scene and the grunge scene kind of came up at the same time, even though they're different genres of music, is because at the time, in the 80s, all that hair metal is so misogynist. I can't even. I know a lot of people were watching that, like, Motley Crue show, TV show that was on Netflix. And I'm like, movie. I can't watch it.
Oh, it's a great movie, but it's fucked up.
I won't watch any of that stuff, or, like, any of the stuff about, like, it's hard for me to even watch Almost Famous, to be honest, because that stuff comes out of, like, that whole groupie real culture stuff. And it comes out of real stuff. Yeah. And so it's actually pretty revolutionary for grunge to have done what it did.
And to be realizing it at the time that it's happening and not have it be something
in real
that,
time.
Yeah.
That you need to retrospect later. Yeah. Because a lot of these people now, if you were to ask them, like, was that fucked up? A lot of them would be like, Oh yeah. I mean,
it was fucked up. So on the day of the Metro 9 concert, a Guns N' Roses fan jumped on stage and begged Kurt to make peace with Rose. Kurt responded, "No, kid, you're really wrong. Those people are total sexist jerks, and the reason we're playing this show is to fight homophobia in a really small way. Axl Rose is a fucking sexist and racist and homophobe, and you can't be on his side and our side."
Way to go.
Yeah, he's, like, potentially turning away fans,
yeah.
So for him,
you're alienating people. You're making people choose sides.
Exactly, and, like, it's not about making money or about appearing a certain way. It's just flat out, this is who I am. You know,
again, it's integrity.
It is, you know? So much integrity. On November 3rd, 1992, Measure 9 was defeated. Whether it be their devil may care attitude or a protest for gay rights, I don't know if I think it's Christ. Novoselic? I was going to look it up, and I totally forgot.
Oh, yeah, I think it is.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. The bassist, and Dave Grohl and Kurt decided to French kiss each other on Saturday Night Live shortly after, which I love. I love Dave Grohl, too.
I love Dave Grohl.
Max just watched a Foo Fighters documentary. I only caught the end of it.
He's a good person.
He's sweet. In an interview for his album Incesticide, he says, "If any of you in any way hate homosexuals, people of a different color, or women, please do this one favor for us. Leave us the fuck alone. Don't come to our shows and don't buy our records." Also in the 90s, Nirvana befriended drag star RuPaul. RuPaul recalls, "These kids come from the same hippie, irreverent, bohemian mentality that I come from. So, of course, they're going to gravitate toward what I'm doing. And a lot of people just don't get that." He would also talk about how when, like, Kurt and Courtney Love would see him, how they would, he would just see this, like, joyful response from them. And they would, he said, they think this is fucking cool.
Yeah.
Like, they just had this really, like, great attitude around
it. Yeah.
RuPaul said that Cobain saw drag for what it really was at its core. Totally punk rock. Kurt was often frustrated by the inequities between men and women. He had always felt a stronger connection with women, as I said. He once said, "I just always felt girls weren't treated with respect, especially because women are totally oppressed." He spoke out a lot about violence against women, particularly rape. In an interview in 1991 with NME, he reflected on a point of view about rape which suggested it was a we problem as opposed to a they problem. So he says, "Rape is one of the most terrible crimes on earth, and it happens every few minutes. The problem with groups who deal with rape is that they educate women about how to defend themselves. What really needs to be done is teaching men not to rape."
Amen.
I mean, the source and start there.
Again, that's such a modern mentality to have. That is not something that was ever really discussed until very, very recently.
This was 1991!
Yeah.
It's great. So, by the way, I got a lot of my information from this article on a website called High Snobiety. They had a lot of really great information. I also got some from Rolling Stone and Wikipedia. So this article in High Snobiety made a really great point in saying that teaching women to defend themselves was really a sort of slut-shaming disguised as female empowerment.
That's exactly right.
Which made so much sense to me, which I've always kind of thought but didn't have, like, the words for. Mm-hmm. Where it's like we're so often teaching these girls different techniques to defend themselves, which is great, and you should. Like, these, we need to know how,
right,
how
we
to defend ourselves.
We don't live in a perfect world.
No.
It's good to know how to defend yourself. Of course it is.
Yeah.
But framing it entirely as a, this is going to happen to you.
Yeah.
So,
and you have no control over it.
You have no control over it.
Sorry.
So put in all of these measures to stop it from happening. Because I don't ever, it was talked to about in school.
Yeah.
You know, in my
health
class.
I remember doing a self-defense, like, demonstration.
Right. It was discussed. I do not remember, and maybe they think that it's something that doesn't need to be explicitly said, but I don't ever remember the men in my, or the boys in my class being lectured on appropriate behavior with women.
Hey, don't rape people.
That was,
people in general. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Don't rape other
maybe
men either.
Maybe keep your fucking hands to yourself.
Don't rape.
Maybe
guys.
Just don't touch people if they didn't ask you to.
It's simple as that.
Just don't do
case
it.
Case closed. He also talks about how he had this friend who worked in, like, a women's crisis center where they would deal with a lot of rape victims. And I guess she was telling him how she was giving, like, a class to these women, or, like, a therapy session or something. And right outside the window was, like, a football team. And how when she was telling Kurt this story, he just was thinking, like, no, they should be the ones in this room right now, not these girls. Like, they know what happened to them. And, like, yes, they need help, but, like, those boys should be in here learning that what their society is telling them is okay isn't okay.
Right.
You know? Very amazing dude. His music often reflected these messages, particularly in songs like Polly and Rape Me. Polly is about a true story involving a 14-year-old girl at a concert who got a ride from a 49-year-old Gerald friend who reportedly raped and tortured her. This name sounds really familiar to me. I feel like I've heard about him before.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't think
friend.
I have.
Because I remember hearing the name friend and being like, oh, that's such an ironic name.
I know some friends.
Well, yeah, but I'm sure your friends are great. This guy is an asshole. I was like, oh, this is a really ironic name for him. She escaped him by jumping out of his truck at a gas station. Friend was arrested and sentenced to 75 years for first-degree kidnapping and rape charges. He was paroled after 20 years. And
you
after,
don't say!
And after two escapes.
You know what? I'm fucking surprised that he was even in prison for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know what? He was probably only in prison for 20 years because he escaped twice.
He escaped twice!
So they kept, like, extending his sentence.
Yeah.
Because usually for rapes, you're out. You're out in, like, 2 years.
Yeah. So bassist Novoselic said of the song, the only chance she had of getting away was to come on to him and persuade him to untie her. That's what she did, and she got away. Can you imagine how much strength that took?
And at 14.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he's referring to the song, so I don't know if he's necessarily referring specifically to this incident, or maybe it's just based on the story in the song. But to be 14, to come on to someone, to get yourself out of a situation, to manipulate him in what he wants to get out of that situation is such a brave act that I would have never even thought of at age 14.
I think I'm not saying I wouldn't have thought of it, but to enact it is something completely different because it would be so counter to all of your instincts, which would be repulsed.
Yeah, but I really love the fact that this is a grown man who's able to put himself into that perspective and realize the strength that it took to go through with that. You know what I mean? So the song Rape Me was written as a battle cry from the point of view of a victim. It was meant to be so blunt that it couldn't be misinterpreted. The song is basically like, go ahead, rape me, beat me, do what you're going to do to me. I'm going to survive. You're not going to kill me. And Kurt says something like, I'm going to rape you, like figuratively, of course. But it's like, this is all going to come back to bite you in the ass in the end. You can do what you want to me, but I'm going to survive and I'm going to be okay. Tori Amos said of the song, the scariest thing to a rape victim are the words rape me. When I first heard it, I broke out in a cold sweat. But when you get over that, you realize he's turning it back on people. At a concert in Oakland, California on New Year's Eve 1993, Kurt confronted a man in the crowd who was groping a woman in the front row. Have you seen this video?
Yes.
It's so great. Kurt stopped playing and threw his guitar on the ground, storming up to security and pointing at the door. He returned to the mic and said, cop it a feel, eh, buddy? Novoselic added, how's it feel, huh? And the band starts, like, laughing and, like, taunting him as he's leaving the venue and, like, really made this guy look like an asshole.
Which good.
He should. Yes. Kurt had a lot of musical integrity and was aware of things like cultural appropriation before the rest of the world knew what that meant. When talking about rap music, he said to Billboard, I'm usually offended by people like Vanilla Ice and stuff like that. The white man ripped off the black man long enough. They should leave rap music to African Americans because they do it so well and it's so vital to them. He would also describe rap music as being the only vital form of music since punk rock. So he was like, you know what? Let's just leave it to the people who know what they're talking about and, like, let's stop stealing shit.
Right, well, because rap music is so culturally important to the black community. But also, I mean, he makes a good point in music. So much popular music has been taken from black America.
Since the beginning of time.
Rock and roll. I mean, all pretty much every form. I read an article once, and it's right. It's like pretty much every form of modern music, including pop music.
Oh, yeah.
Rock music is black music.
It is.
Rock music is black music.
That's what evolved into pop music.
Jazz music, blues music.
Yeah.
All of this stuff, all of it is African-American
music.
We owe it all. That was stolen from African-Americans.
Exactly. Exactly. And the fact that he was able to not only realize that, but articulate it to people and talk about it, I think is really cool. So a little bit about his personal life. Kurt first met Courtney Love in 1990 at a nightclub. She made romantic advances, but Kurt wasn't sure he wanted to be in a relationship. They would soon bond over drug use, and by 1992, Courtney was pregnant with Frances Bean. At one point, the LA County Department of Children's Services took the Cobains to court, stating that they were unfit parents. She had done an interview with Vanity Fair where she mentioned something about still using heroin before she knew she was pregnant. It took a really long time for her to try to articulate the fact that she stopped when she was pregnant.
When she knew she was pregnant.
Yeah, and then I'm pretty sure she used after she had the baby.
They both did. Yeah. They both did. I mean, this is such a tragic example of what happens to good, talented people when they get addicted to drugs. Because you can watch in that montage of Heck, you can watch home videos. He's nodding off with the baby in his arms. Like, they're fucked up. Like,
yeah,
they're both
hard time
incredibly fucked up. And it's so sad because it's such a good example of the fact that, like, drug use doesn't mean that you're a bad person.
No.
Like, at all. It just means that you're a person struggling with something you can't control.
Yeah, and that drugs and alcohol are a way of coping. You know what I mean? It's a very unhealthy coping mechanism. Yeah, I read today that Frances Bean actually had some issues of drug abuse as well, which is
not surprising
to me, you know? So, unfortunately, Kurt's legacy is laced with drug use. He took a lot of LSD at one point. He also took acid, drank heavily, and abused solvents, which I'm like, eee.
Hey, yikes.
His heroin use started around 1986 in Washington, and by 1990, it was a full-on addiction. He claimed that he used drugs as a way to self-medicate this, like, chronic stomach problem that he had, but everyone's like, it made it worse. Like,
well, and it may have been that was how he started.
Rationalized it.
I mean, and it also, he could have started using drugs thinking that maybe it would numb him out, but once you get addicted, it's like, you're not using it for anything other than to get high at
exactly.
that point.
But that may have been his way to like rationalize it to the public as well. He also suffered from chronic bronchitis, which as a singer, that sucks. So on March 1st, 1994, he was diagnosed again with bronchitis and laryngitis.
He was also super fucking depressed. Like, he was depressed throughout his entire life. It was an ongoing...
He suffered. He really suffered. He flew to Rome for treatment the next day with Courtney. The day after that, Courtney woke up to find Kurt had overdosed on a combination of champagne and rohypnol, which is used for severe insomnia. He was rushed to the hospital and was released 5 days later and returned to Seattle. There was a few other incidents that happened between this time and when he passed away. There was a time when he said he was going to commit suicide and locked himself in a room with a gun, and the cops came and confiscated a bottle of pills and all, and like several.
See, to me,
guns.
There are lots of people, and sorry, Sienna. Sienna loves Kurt Cobain. She's going to love that we're talking about him.
Oh, good.
But she's not going to love this. There are a lot of people who don't think that Kurt Cobain killed himself, that hold Courtney Love responsible for it. To me, especially...
Well, she holds herself responsible for it.
But people think that she directly killed him.
Oh, okay.
Which I don't think is the case at all. No. Because if you look into his life, you watch that documentary, you read his diary entries, you watch everything that led up to his death, to me, there is no question that he killed himself.
Well, and I think the thing is that there's a lot of shame that surrounds somebody who completes suicide. You know, I feel like that's something that people don't want to believe about their idols, and people hold a very high standard to those people, and there's such a stigma around seeing the people who complete suicide as being weak or...
He was mentally ill and on very serious drugs.
Well, and that's the thing, is that the stigma around it is to look down upon those people, when I don't believe that there's any... shame in remembering somebody who tried as hard as he could and just couldn't do it anymore. And I don't think there's anything wrong with admitting to the fact that he committed suicide. I don't think that takes away from his legacy.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I agree.
So on April 8th, Kurt's body was found in his home by his electrician. At first, he only saw a small amount of blood coming out of Kurt's ear and thought he could be sleeping until he saw the shotgun pointing at Kurt's chin. A note was found addressed to his childhood imaginary friend, Boda, expressing his love for creating music. A large amount of heroin and diazepam were found in his system. He had been lying there for 3 days, his date of death being April 5th, 1994. He was 27 years old.
Yeah.
And there is a
27.
Long list of 20. I'm turning 27 this year, Keegan.
Yeah, listen.
I'm not famous enough.
I made it to 29. You're going to be okay. But yeah, I mean... There's Jimi Hendrix, there's Janis Joplin, a lot of people have passed away.
So young. Now that I'm almost 27, I'm like,
it's so young.
Oh. And they've done so much more than me. I'm like, what am I doing?
It's so young. I mean, honestly.
So young. So in 2005, a sign was put up in his hometown of Aberdeen, Washington, reading, "Welcome to Aberdeen, come as you are," in tribute to Kurt. And before I finish, I forgot to write this in my notes, but the quote that made me... really, really want to talk about him was this. Let me find it. He says, "I am definitely a feminist. I'm fucking disgusted by the way women are still treated. It's 1993 and some people still think we're in the 1950s. We need to make more progress. There needs to be more female musicians, more female artists, more female writers. Everything is dominated by fucking males and I'm sick of it." And that, to me, just kind of embodies everything that he was and believed in and spoke out against, and has such artistic and moral integrity that I admire so much.
Yeah, he was a true ally. And I think it's important to point to people like this whenever people say that men can't control themselves, because this is a man who had tremendous influence and power. He was so popular and famous. If he had wanted to abuse his situation, like all of those hair bands in the 80s and all of those bands in the 70s did, and claimed that, you know, of course they would. Why wouldn't you? You know, like, we were handed all of this influence.
Yeah, a lot of times your morals
he fucking,
go out the window.
But he didn't. So... Nope. If he didn't do it, you didn't have to do it either. And there's no real excuse for you, except for that you wanted to take advantage of the situation.
Yeah,
and you're kind of a piece of shit.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. He held on to his morals for his entire life and didn't just talk the talk, he walked the walk.
Yeah.
And his music so directly affects his beliefs and the way that he wanted the world to be. And it's such a shame that somebody who was so forward-thinking had to die so young and so far before a lot of this time, because thinking about these people and what they could do today is so beautiful. But at the same time, he made such a lasting impact even to this day, only being around for 27 years and right. passing away so long ago. And so I think that instead of, you know, me being sad and wanting him to be around today to be a part of this movement now, I have to appreciate the fact that he really paved the way for a lot of people, and
yes.
particularly a lot of men,
yeah.
to see that it's okay to be mm-hmm. a feminist and to stand up for women and people of color and people of the LGBTQ community. That doesn't make you gay. That doesn't make you yeah. feminine. That doesn't make you
He influenced a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't have received that message. Uh-huh. So that's
He made it cool.
Really, really cool. Yeah, it's really, really cool. And it is really sad. And again, I just want to drive home that, like, it is such a perfect example of the horrors of addiction,
yeah,
you know, and that we have a tendency to look down on people who are addicted as some kind of moral failing.
Yeah, exactly.
And it is a physical dependency
yeah.
that causes you to not be yourself.
Yeah, and, like, and that's why they call it a disease. That was something that I really had a hard time with growing up, is understanding that, you know, something like alcoholism could be a disease, because I was like, it's not like he's sick. You know,
it seems
it's
like
not
a choice.
Like, yeah, it right. really does seem like a choice, but there really is
and,
a chemical
And listen, there is an initial choice that
yeah,
you make.
There is,
there
of
is
course.
An initial choice, but at some point, it does become a physical dependency, and also, addiction is genetic. As
it's,
well.
Yeah.
Like, your propensity towards it is genetic.
And it's genetic, and it's also something that I feel like a lot of people don't understand about the ways that people respond to mental illness, is that it is a coping mechanism. Some people are able to, just on their own, discover very healthy coping mechanisms. We talk a lot about Self-Care Sunday, things like that, where they've found their own ways of coping with life in a healthy, effective way. But for me, and for a lot of other people, I didn't have that way of thinking. I didn't go to healthy ways of coping. I went to very self-destructing ways of coping, because that's what worked for me for a very long time and served its purpose. And I think that that was something that he experienced as well.
Right. Agreed. Well, thank you for
yeah.
bringing that story. I think we had some pretty good ones this
week.
We
did. Kind of similar in a way again.
They like, were, I mean, it's really, they were two people, because I feel like in order to be a successful, really successful feminist in the music industry, you do have to have, you have to go in with very set beliefs
boundaries.
And boundaries and integrity kind of set in place already in order to be successful
you
at it.
You have to stick to them.
And you have to, because you have to stick to them. And
yeah.
like, that's, it's so hard to do once you start getting a certain amount of fame and money. You know, it's very easy to kind of be like, well,
yeah.
is it as important as I thought it was?
Once we make it big, we're just going to be your angry basic bitches.
Totally, total sellouts.
And we're just going to sell
completely.
Out yeah. 100%.
Sell out hard.
Hard. We're going to be rolling in the money.
Well, if you have stories that you would like to submit to us, please email us at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com. You can also write to us on Instagram and on Facebook. We do receive messages there as well. You can follow us on Instagram at Angry Neighborhood Feminist. You can get us on Facebook. We have a business page and a group page. You can find us on Twitter at YANF Podcast, YANF Podcast. You can also leave us a review for our Reviews Day Tuesday on Apple Podcasts, is where we most appreciate those reviews and ratings.
Yes.
But we will also take them on our Facebook page. We love those as well. We also have two episodes where we need your participation.
Need.
Coming up in the next month. June is Gay Pride Month. So we are wanting to do another coming out episode. It was
yes.
such a big success last year. We want all of your stories of when you came out to your family, good, bad, all of it. It was such a moving episode for us to do, and I know our listeners loved it as well last year. So if you're not familiar, go back, listen to that episode. You know, so you can, if you're on the fence about whether or not you want to submit a story, listen to that episode.
Yeah, you'll really love it. Our deadline for that is going to be June 18th for your stories for that. And what Keegan was also going to get to is the fatherhood episode. We are going to be putting that episode up the day after Father's Day, but we need all of your stories in by June 11th. We don't have any fatherhood stories yet. We really, really need your help, because if we don't get enough stories, we can't do the episode. And there are
people... I mean, you and I could probably dig up enough shit on our own dads to talk about for an hour. But
for
like,
sure.
Do you want that, listeners?
I mean, they might. I don't know. Let us know. But we would love to also talk... I mean, I feel like also when you read stories about other people's fathers and families, it relates back to your own experience in some way, too. So either way, you'll learn plenty about us. But we really, really would love your stories. So please email them, direct message them, anything like that. Please also listen to us on Radio Public. We really appreciate our listeners who do that. It's a free way for you to listen, and it helps us out a little bit along the way. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you guys really enjoyed it as much as we did. With all that being said, we encourage you
to rage on.
Bye.